This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a cautious welcome for Shanghai's free trade zone. We'll ask whether this will open up the world's second largest economy.
And Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House is here to set the day's agenda. Jane, what are we looking at today?
We're going to be talking about the politics between Israel and Iran, some interesting attempts at democratisation in Turkey, and some little-watched progress in Tunisia.
Plus, we'll speak to Ivan Cavallo in Milan as Italy's Prime Minister faces a vote of confidence.
And the Brazilian film director Paulo Henrique Fontanelli will join us in the studio to talk about his latest documentary.
O senhor presidente da República deixou a sede do governo. Assim sendo, declaro vaga a presidência da República.
All that, plus we'll get the latest news from Denmark with Michael Booth, possibly even some music too. All to come in the next hour, here on Midori House.
First though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and his Pakistani counterpart Nawaz Sharif have agreed to work to restore a cross-border ceasefire after a spate of shootings strained relations. They met on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York amid heightened tension over the Kashmir region, sparked by a series of fatal clashes on their de facto Himalayan border. India said the talks had been useful. Pakistan said the atmosphere had been very positive. Meanwhile, the number of people killed by Sunday's car bombing in the Pakistani city of Peshawar has risen to 42. It was the third attack in the area in a week and came 7 days after a double suicide bombing killed more than 80 people outside a church. Pakistan's foreign policy chief, Sartaj Aziz, says stopping the attacks is a priority for the government.
Peshawar is very close to the tribal area, so it's a very easy target for the extremists. And incident after incident take place. And these suicide attacks are very difficult to control because a person who looks like anybody else walking on the street is carrying things under his clothes or shirt or shawl. And even if you stop him at the right place, he can explode there and then the security people and those around him are killed.
Italy's Prime Minister Enrico Letta is to go to Parliament to seek a solution to the crisis crippling his coalition government. A confidence vote will be held on Wednesday. The move was announced after Mr. Letta had talks with President Giorgio Napolitano. The relationship between Mr. Letta's centre-left grouping and ex-Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right party is at rock bottom. Berlusconi pulled his five ministers out of the administration on Saturday, but those ministers have now given mixed signals as to whether they are actually leaving the government. Political analyst James Walston of the American University of Rome says President Napolitano doesn't want early elections.
He will do everything he can to prevent early elections, and his nuclear option, his strongest possible point, is to threaten to resign. If he resigns, then with the present parliamentary setup, the most likely person to become president is Romano Prodi, who is very much against Berlusconi. So that is a very strong incentive for Berlusconi and his people to allow things to go on.
The Kenyan government says the death toll from last week's Nairobi shopping centre attack, claimed by the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali group Al-Shabaab, remains at 67. 9 people are currently in custody over the raid. The most recent arrest came on Sunday. Government forces in Mali are engaged in a gun battle with suspected separatist rebels in the north of the country. Fighting began when gunmen attacked soldiers who were guarding a bank in the town of Kidal. The rebels are believed to be from a Tuareg group, which has just announced that it's pulling out of peace talks. Kidal was in the hands of rebels from the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad for months until government forces moved back in following June's ceasefire. The US Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who's on his first trip to South Korea, has visited the demilitarized zone at the border with North Korea. He was accompanied by South Korea's Defense Minister Kim Kwan-jin to an observation post where he met South Korean soldiers guarding the border.
This is a very important location for our relationship. We probably have a clear identification of the Iraq-U.S. partnership here more than anywhere else, the coordination of our efforts. This is obviously a critical area that assures, with our joint vigilance, the security and safety of South Korea and peace in this region.
A plane has skidded off the runway at Rome's Fiumicino Airport after its landing gear malfunctioned during a thunderstorm. The Italian ANSA news agency reports that nobody was injured in the incident. The aircraft, an Airbus A320 belonging to Alitalia, had flown from Madrid with 151 passengers on board. It came to rest on its side near the runway. The National Air Transport Safety Agency has opened an investigation. The Sochi 2014 Winter Olympic torch has been lit in ancient Olympia, heralding the start of what will be the longest torch relay for any Winter Games, including a trip to space. The Black Sea Resort, the first Russian city to stage a Winter Olympics, will receive the flame on October the 5th. A 123-day odyssey will follow, culminating at the opening ceremony on February the 7th. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Barney Burnham. It is now 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The time is 8.07 here in London. It's time, therefore, to set the day's news agenda with the stories you need to know today. Joining us now is Jane Kinnaman, Senior Research Fellow in Middle East and North Africa at Chatham House, the London-based Policy Research Institute. Welcome back to the show.
Good
to have you as ever, Jane. There was a meeting between Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu today. Two men who don't necessarily get on very well at all. I mean, a well-publicised disagreement with them the whole time. But the focus of this meeting today is the very surprising, startling comments by Iran's Rouhani last week, which knocked everybody for six.
That's right. The Middle East has been on something of a roller coaster. Just a few weeks ago, we were looking at the real possibility of the US bombing Syria. Now we see the US and Iranian foreign ministers sitting together, apparently laughing, when the US and Iran have not previously had diplomatic contacts since 1980. But not very much of substance has changed yet, and this seems to be something Netanyahu wants to raise. What's really changing about Iran's policy?
And he obviously doesn't want Obama to let up at all on the whole issue of sanctions.
Absolutely. The Israelis are generally quite worried that Rouhani is basically going to maintain the same policy as Ahmadinejad, but play it in a much smarter way. He's much more media savvy, internationally friendly. He's made a great impression on the West so far without actually making any concessions.
It is an astonishing statement that he made last week, and the fact that he himself was the victim of having shoes thrown at him when he got back to Tehran. But in terms of the way that this now alters Israel's position, it's deeply unsettling for Israel, seeing as, you know, Rouhani said that Israel should give up its nuclear weapons if it really means what it says about the denuclearization of the Middle East. How much does Israel depend in terms of its identity on enmity with Iran?
Before the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Iran and Israel were allies, so it has been possible in the past. But under Netanyahu's time in office, Iran has been seen as the number one security threat for Israel, while the Palestinian issue has somehow receded into the background. So it would be extremely difficult for Netanyahu to publicly change his position on Iran, even if he wanted to.
Now, Obama meeting or speaking to Rouhani was a very big event, but actually meeting with Netanyahu is not so unusual. He saw him just 6 months ago, and he gave him all those assurances that he's asking for again today. So why even the need for another meeting?
Well, it's absolutely routine. It's ironic that while there are these personal differences much reported between Obama and Netanyahu, of course, the two countries are very firm allies, and that's been the case for a long time. It's partly important for Netanyahu's domestic constituency that he's seen to be pressing this issue, that he's seen to have access to still the most powerful man in the world. It also, for Obama, it's the equivalent of the shoe throwing. It allows him to say to Rouhani, look, I'd like to go further, but I have to be careful. People are keeping me in check too.
Well, being kept in check as well as the two of them, the Turkish Prime Minister. Let's move on there now, because they're unveiling a democratisation package of political and legal reforms. It's intended to weaken military influence over politics.
This is fascinating. Turkey is one of the most democratic countries in the region, but it's still emerging from the shadow of military dictatorship. The Prime Minister believes there was a coup plot against him a few years ago, and here he's trying to unveil packages to reduce the power of the military, especially the military police, to have more scrutiny of torture, but also to bring in more rights for the country's minorities, especially the Kurds.
In terms of the way that this so-called democracy package is being put forward, many of the critics have said that they're in a country where freedom of speech is stifled, there's extensive pretrial detention, the right to protest has been stifled as well, given the recent events in Istanbul. Plus the fact that Erdogan has put forward a democracy package, or is just about to put forward a democracy package, without actually consulting anybody about it. What does this actually say about the state of democracy in Turkey?
Well, it raises questions about what's important in a democracy. Erdogan would say that his party received more than 50% of the vote in the last elections and therefore they have a democratic mandate. But he has been criticised for not taking the opinions of the very large minority who are against him into account, especially with the protests. Here he's trying to bring in ethnic groups on the basis of their identity, but still not giving very much recognition to the idea of political opposition having an important role to play as part of a democracy.
Well, you're absolutely right, because there is this whole minorities issue there. The citizenship demands of minorities who are born in Turkey but they live abroad will be taken into consideration with all of this, these new packages. Also, interestingly, headscarves. Women will be allowed to work in the public service wearing a headscarf. And that's a very recent reversal, isn't it?
Yes, and this is something that's squarely aimed at his own constituents, many of whom are religiously pious people who are from the emerging middle class, who have become wealthier under his presidency. Many of them have moved into the cities from rural areas and they wear headscarves, but they do encounter a lot of prejudice from traditional secular urban Turks who see this as something backwards and something that goes against Turkish secularism. Similar debate to France.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, as a whole, this will mean for the region?
The success of the Turkish model is really important for the region, because this is, you know, probably the longest running experiment with democracy in the area, and to see it damaged, to see the sheen taken off it by the protests and the violence around it them last year was something that was really very disturbing. There aren't enough models going right, and so it's essential.
But if you have two things that are being sort of approached by Turkey at the moment, which is first and foremost a negotiated end to the conflict with the PKK, plus the ultimate goal, which is to become part of the EU, those are two things which would naturally open up the country to a more democratic process. Why the need for a democratic package?
Unfortunately, those talks with the EU have stalled for years. I'm just back from Istanbul, and when you talk to economists or politicians there, it's almost a joke now. Nobody thinks that this process is going anywhere or that it's likely to go anywhere anytime soon. So people are thinking, what can be done domestically to drive democratisation forward? But they really disagree about what democratisation means.
Jane, let's move on to Tunisia, whose government announced yesterday that it will step down in favour of a government of national unity. What does this mean for the country's political transition?
This may be a piece of good news, and Tunisia's transition isn't watched as much as what's happening in Egypt or Syria. It's a much smaller country, not as economically important. But this is where the Arab Spring started. Mm. And they have been very slowly, with a lot of difficulties, making progress trying to negotiate their own new constitution. The Islamists that have dominated the constituent assembly there have obviously been really alarmed by what they see in Egypt, and it looks like they're wanting to avoid the same happening to them.
Very briefly, Jane, the difficulty is, though, that you have this fundamental schism between an Islamic identity but a very Western-looking approach as well. How are they ever going to resolve that, though?
Well, this is something they're debating and experimenting with, but it's not impossible. It's interesting that one of the most influential figures in the Islamist Ennahda party, Rashid Ghannouchi, spent about 20 years of his life in London as a political exile. He's written about the compatibility of democracy and Islam. He doesn't necessarily see the West and the East as being opposed.
Jane Kinnamont, thank you very much. Senior Research Fellow in Middle East and North Africa at Chatham House. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again very shortly.
Still to come on Midori House, a check-in with our man in Copenhagen. But first we head to Shanghai, which has a brand new free trade zone.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Cote d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set, this means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's sporting report and over 350 more films on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:16. Now, it's been hailed as China's biggest step yet towards economic openness. A free trade zone in Shanghai has opening the way to, well, nobody's quite sure yet.
Details of exactly what's in it are still sketchy. All that's clear is that, such as its popularity, homes next to the zone are sold out and the share prices of some of the companies thought to be involved have soared. And the zone's only been open 2 days. Simon Ravinovich is from the Financial Times. He joins us now on the line from Shanghai. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thank you.
Simon, this is a really important week for China for many reasons, but on Tuesday, the country will mark the 64th anniversary of their liberation by the forces of Chairman Mao Zedong. Officials have been ordered to watch documentaries on the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it all appears to be a warning against liberal ideas. So surely that's completely at odds with the events now in Shanghai.
If you look at China's path of development since the end of the Mao era, since the late 1970s, it's very clear that they have pursued economic openness and what you might think of as liberalization, at the same time as obviously being quite conservative still politically. So what we're seeing now with Xi Jinping's administration cracking down on free speech, cracking down on the internet, but at the same time pursuing economic reforms, that's really of a piece with the model of development that they followed for more than three decades now.
How do they reconcile that, though, when you have, like, as you say, the reforms by Xi Jinping to suppress freedom of speech, ever more closely monitoring of the likes of Weibo, yet within this new free trade zone, you're going to get effectively a Western-style operation? How is this Western-style operation going to function when you actually have such tight controls everywhere else?
I wouldn't say that they're going to have a Western-style operation within the free trade zone. I mean, as you alluded to in your intro to the segment, it's still very unclear what exactly is going to be there. But I think it is pretty clear that last week there had been this idea that they might actually have no internet controls, full access to Facebook, Twitter, and the like in the free trade zone. It's been quite clear afterwards that that's not going to happen. Those reports were actually misinformed. Now, free trade zone, obviously, when you hear free trade zone, you think that has a lot to do with free trade, which would make sense. But of course, in this case, the reason there's so much excitement is that free trade is actually something of a misnomer. And really what they're looking at is a whole series of different financial and economic reforms, opening up the capital account, allowing banks to operate more freely, allowing foreign companies to invest in a wide range of sectors. So it's really much more than just free trade, but it is still concentrated on economics and on finance, not on political opening.
And to what degree is it being seen as a test ground for financial reform or indeed political reform?
Well, the government itself, in describing the zone at its launch, said that it was going to be a test bed for all of these different economic and financial, but not political reforms. And so that's one of the reasons that hopes have been running extremely high. Those hopes and the expectations have been dialed back a little bit over the past couple of days. Yesterday was the ribbon-cutting ceremony, and the highest-ranking official there was Gao Hongcheng, the commerce minister, the premier, who is believed to be one of the driving forces behind the zone, was not there. The central bank governor, who will play a critical role if they are going to proceed with big financial reforms, was not there. So what seems to be happening is the government is trying to manage expectations a little bit. It is going to be an important laboratory for reforms, but I think we have to be realistic about what one small 28.8 square kilometer section of Shanghai can actually achieve.
Simon Rabinovich in Shanghai, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's cross over to Hong Kong, where we can join our bureau chief there, Aisha Spears. Welcome to the show, Aisha. Simon Rabinovich has just been describing the Shanghai free trade zone as a test bed for financial reform. What effect is that going to have on Hong Kong, which for years has been seen as the gateway to investment and foreign companies into China?
I think, well, Hong Kong, there's a couple of key issues here which were pointed out in an editorial from today's South China Morning Post, which is that Hong Kong and the Shanghai Free Trade Zone will differ quite considerably in that there won't be market-determined interest rates in Shanghai and there won't be a free flow of capital, both of which are things that the very, very free laissez-faire economy of Hong Kong does enjoy. I mean, obviously, Hong Kong is talking about this. It's a big deal here for everyone from taxi drivers to economists are wondering what the impact will be. Most people see that the impact really won't, we won't notice it for a long time. It will take years to properly establish Shanghai's free trade zone, whereas Hong Kong's is already in existence.
Aisha, we're seeing that Beijing has been quick to reassure Hong Kong that Shanghai doesn't pose a threat. But really, on the ground, when you're there, you're talking to people every day. As you say, it's a huge talking point. There's really no nervousness?
There is a little nervousness, I think. But I think, you know, the important thing to also consider is, you know, Hong Kong's position politically and economically with relation to China is a little bit turbulent anyway. There's all sorts of things that could change over the next 20 years or so. This three-year period that Shanghai are in and kind of testing out to see what will happen with this free trade zone is very much an experiment. And so I think that Hong Kong is kind of watching what will happen. Most economists are saying that nothing will happen, nothing will really affect the city, the special administrative region, yet. And there's a possibility that it could also do well for Hong Kong. As Shanghai grows, the yuan's power will too, which can only benefit Hong Kong. 16% of China's trade is denominated in the renminbi, and it's currently a large amount of that passes through Hong Kong. About 10% of Hong Kong's banking system is comprised of yuan deposits. So if Shanghai grows, and that could be a good thing for Hong Kong as well.
That's Monocle's Aisha Spears in Hong Kong. Thanks very much. Up next, we're in Copenhagen.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Cookery books that leave a bad taste in the mouth? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple, salt, pepper, fennel pollen. Simple, tasty.
I think food off a grill really just tastes exceptional. It's the sort of thing I like to eat, you know. Lamb, chicken, even octopus, squid, always tastes good.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
You don't make business lunches here. You come usually alone or with somebody that you know very well, because it's home style. You have to feel familiar with someone to eat in such a place.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with Georgina Godwin and Emma Nelson. The time in Copenhagen is just nudging 9:24 a.m. It's where we head next to speak to our man there, Michael Booth. Welcome to the show, Michael. You have a raft of subjects to throw in our direction, including big boats and an S&M scandal involving the Prime Minister.
Not quite, but a kind of fictional S&M scandal. There's the publishing sensation of the week or the last couple of weeks has been a book by a crime writer called Jens Christian Grøndahl, who's very well known in Denmark and translated into many languages. He has written a book that's kind of a cross between Primary Colors and 50 Shades of Grey. He wrote it pseudonymously under the name Christian Tornbacher. It's called De Gode's Pris, kind of means the price paid by the good. And basically, it tells the story of a female Danish prime minister who bears an uncanny resemblance to Helle Thorning-Schmidt, the actual female prime minister of Denmark. His fictionalized version is named Ellen Wilson Koch, and she's beautiful. Her children go to a private school. She has an English husband who's having tax difficulties, all of which could apply to the real prime minister, except for in Christian Grøndahl's story, the prime minister becomes blackmailed when some photographs of her engaging in S&M acts from her earlier life mailed to a journalist.
Now, of course, nobody's saying anything definite about her sexual history, how would we possibly know? But on the occasion of her marriage to Neil Kinnock's son, he, of course, famously ran and lost in 1992 against John Major here in Britain for the Labour Party. There were all sorts of allegations that his son, Stephen, to whom Schmidt is married, was gay.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're allowed to talk about those, actually. But, yeah, they've also been given an airing in the Danish media over the last few years. They do have a kind of unconventional setup, Stephen Kinnock and Helle Thorning-Schmidt, in that he has lived in Russia for a long time and kind of commuted between Moscow and Copenhagen and also from Switzerland, which led to some tricky business with the Danish tax authorities.
Mm. Mm. Is it any good, the book?
Well, before it was before the actual writer was exposed, it got middling reviews and didn't sell very well. Of course, it's rather like the J.K. Rowling book recently. Well, as soon as everyone knew who had written it, there was renewed interest, put it that way.
There is that unnecessarily unhealthy interest in Denmark, isn't there, to female political leaders, rather brilliantly done in Borgen. Let's see what happens with this book. Let's move on to something that has been absolutely dominating the water in Copenhagen for the last couple of days. A very, very big boat, or is it a very big white elephant, Michael?
Well, it's called Majestic Maersk, and it's the biggest ship in the world. I went down to see it the other day, and it's docked in Copenhagen for the first time. It's brand new, and it's a bit like as if Manhattan had docked alongside Copenhagen. It is truly huge. I'm going to have to read out some figures for you. It is, what was it?
As long as four football fields.
It's about 400 metres long, which is about as long as you could possibly imagine. Are there lots of people standing looking at it going, wow, it's really big, and being unable to make any other comment on it?
Yeah, well, it's been open to the public for free, and you can go in and take a look. Sorry, it's 59 metres wide, 400 metres long, and 73 metres high. And I think the most amazing statistic is it can sail from China to southern Spain in just 20 hours. And they've Maersk has spun it quite well. I mean, when you think about it, shipping contributes quite significantly to pollution and climate change and so forth. But they're saying the bigger the ship, the more economical, the less environmental impact it is. So that's the thinking behind it. It has a sub-name, which is Triple E, which stands for Energy Efficiency, Economy of Scale and Environmentally Improved.
Should it have a fourth one, which is half empty?
Well, it has space for 18,270 containers. Well, it's going to sail from Gothenburg to China.
Let's move on now to restaurants, because it's the biggest restaurant opening in Copenhagen for years. The Standard, three restaurants and a jazz club.
That's right. Opens this week. It's in a former ferry terminal building on the harbour front, across the water from Noma, and it's actually part owned by the founder of Noma, Klaus Meyer. He's known for the New Nordic Manifesto and New Nordic food, but actually the most interesting thing for me as a Brit living in Denmark is that there's going to be a fantastic Indian restaurant as part of this restaurant complex, run by the people who run the Michelin-starred Trishna in Marylebone in London. is going to be called Veranda, and that's the one I'm looking forward to.
To what degree is this an opening up of Danish food? I mean, we know so much about the brilliance of locally sourced food that Denmark has become so famous for in the last couple of years. But is it, you know, any great surprise that a big Indian restaurant is opening?
Well, I think the market, I mean, I should add that there are the other two restaurants in this complex are new Nordic food to the bone. But I should add, I think that kind of food has reached saturation point a bit in Copenhagen. There are so many ex-Noma chefs, and there are ex-Noma chefs behind the new Nordic restaurants in this new complex. So many of them now spreading out in Copenhagen. There is a problem with lack of choice, actually.
Michael, thanks very much. Michael Booth in Copenhagen, thank you for joining us today.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be in Italy, where Prime Minister Enrico Letta is battling through a political crisis. We'll review the Turkish newspapers with Alexandra de Kramer, and Brazilian film director Paulo Henrique Fontanelle will join us in the studio to discuss his latest documentary.
O senhor presidente da República deixou a sede do governo. Assim sendo, declaro vaga a presidência da República.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and his Pakistani counterpart Nawaz Sharif have agreed to work to restore a cross-border ceasefire after a spate of shootings in the Kashmir region strained relations. Italy's Prime Minister Enrico Letta is to go to Parliament to seek a solution to the crisis crippling his coalition government. A confidence vote will be held on Wednesday after ex-Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi pulled his five ministers out of the administration. The Kenyan government says the death toll from last week's Nairobi shopping centre attack remains at 67. Nine people are currently in custody over the raid. The most recent arrest came on Sunday. Government forces in Mali are engaged in a gun battle with suspected separatist rebels in the north of the country. Fighting began when gunmen attacked soldiers who were guarding a bank in the town of Kidal. An Alitalia Airbus A320 has skidded off the runway at Rome's Fiumicino Airport after its landing gear malfunctioned during a thunderstorm. There are no reports of any injuries in the incident. And the Sochi 2014 Winter Olympic torch has been lit in ancient Olympia, heralding the start of what will be the longest torch relay for any Winter Games, including a trip to space. The torch will reach Sochi on Saturday. That will be followed by a 123-day odyssey, culminating at the opening ceremony on February the 7th. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Barney Burnham, and more news, of course, at the top of the hour. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Emma Nelson.
Italy is in turmoil yet again. The country's had more than 60 governments since the end of the Second World War, and the current one, which took more than 3 months to build earlier on this year, is on the brink of collapse.
On Saturday, the centre-right leader, Silvio Berlusconi, ordered five of his ministers out of the coalition. And last night, the country's Prime Minister, Enrico Letta, held crisis talks with President Giorgio Napolitano. One thing the country can ill afford is for the government to collapse now and for fresh elections to be called. Monocle's man in Milan is Ivan Cavallo. Welcome to the show, Ivan.
Good morning.
How have we got to this point again?
Well, it seems that Silvio Berlusconi, who celebrated his birthday yesterday, decided to give himself a government crisis as a present, and here we are. It's, of course, known that Berlusconi was facing an impeachment vote in the Senate due to his conviction for tax fraud, and it looks like he's putting personal interests above the Enrico Letta himself had stated to the media over the weekend.
Ivan, you seem to, your line seems to be a little bit wonky, but we will persist with you and hope that Berlusconi hasn't thrown a spanner in these particular works either. And it seems like a personal vendetta here by Berlusconi, as you say, could have potentially long-reaching ramifications for the long-term stability of Italy's economy.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, as you mentioned in your opener, Italy is known for government instability, but and the economy tends to go on and get by. But recently, the country is in a deep, deep economic crisis. We're looking at the longest recession in the post-war period. And there needs to be structural reforms that need to help the economy get out of this very slow negative growth period. And the businesses are pleading for stability so that measures in labor market reform, cuts in public administration can be taken so that the economy can be, again, righted on a growth course.
Well, because it's already in danger of failing to meet its deficit target, isn't it? The EU and the IMF are both very cross.
Well, you know, Letta has threatened that, look, if this government falls, then you're going to see the Troika come in. So in terms of getting the deficit at the 3%, which has been asked by Brussels, Italy is in pretty good shape on that issue. They were only going to need to do a small measure. But now with this turmoil, that there was going to be a vote on trying to sort out to prevent a rise in value-added tax. And then, of course, there's a property tax, which nobody likes, which the Monti government had put through. And Berlusconi is playing the tax card, saying, I'm trying to protect people's pocketbooks, saying, I don't want to raise taxes on the electorate. And that's a card that he's trying to play. But a lot of people, even with his own party, I mean, there are ministers who were asked to resign who are saying, look, I don't see this as a good measure. This is something that is distracting from the big concerns of the country. So later today, members of his party are going to meet, and you might just see some tensions in that meeting.
So if you're waking up in Milan or Rome or Florence or wherever thinking, right, what have I got in the next week in terms of political leadership, is there still going to be a coalition in the next few days? I mean, are we looking at Giorgio Napolitano sweeping in as he did a few months ago and bashing everybody's heads together and saying, sort this out?
Well, Enrico Letta has given himself till Wednesday for this confidence vote, and there is talk that he might be able to scrape together a majority in the Senate, because in the lower house he has the majority, but because of this strange electoral law that Italy was left with by actually Berlusconi's minister in 2005, and the way the results came out for the Senate vote, he needs to find seven seats, seven votes is what the talk is right now. And if he can get some defectors, even from within Berlusconi's party, some of the Cinque Stelle, Beppe Grillo's five-star movement, who are a bit disillusioned with their leader, who actually wants to now go to a new fresh elections to revive his support. If Letta can survive this week on a confidence vote, maybe we'll go through to till next week or week after, unless there's, of course, another crisis might pop up on some other issue.
What is your opinion, your personal opinion? Do you think Letta can survive this?
I think it's interesting to see what happens with Berlusconi's parliamentarians at 5 o'clock this afternoon to see what happens there. If there are tensions in the ranks there, some people saying, look, we want to be responsible to the country at this time because it's a critical moment, and you might see some defections there. Berlusconi has relaunched his Forza Italia party, which is when he first came into politics in 1994, you know, based on a football chant of Go Italy, and he's always up for a campaign. Whether or not governing is, of course, another question, whether he's able to do that. But he's itching for a fight. And, of course, because of this impeachment vote, he's trying to get out of that by precipitating a crisis in the government.
Ivan Carvalho in Milan, thank you very much, as ever, for joining us on the programme.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be joined by Brazilian film director Paulo Henrique Fontanelle.
Shops. Who needs them? Well, we all do if you want a vibrant neighbourhood, a sense of community, healthy food and outlets for small producers. In the October issue of Monocle, we check out the future of retail around the world and meet the people who believe in bricks and mortar shops. It's an inspiring round of global window shopping.
In the affairs section, we take a look at the politics behind Iran's retail sector. We meet the unusual team of advisors helping Mexico City's new mayor transform his hometown. And we sit down for coffee with Canada's national icon, Margaret Atwood.
In the business section, we roll down the shutters and set out our stall with a survey that makes the case for bricks and mortar shopkeeping. We seek out the brands reinventing retail from Shanghai to Philadelphia. Then we journey to Italy to meet the family-run businesses that still stand as benchmarks for service and quality and create secure and close-knit neighbourhoods.
In the culture section, we investigate Israel's new challenger in the fraught battle to be heard in the media war of rolling news. We look ahead to the Frieze Art Fair in London and muse on when a film really is a work of art.
And there's a lot more to ponder, digest and enjoy too. The October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
This week, Monocle 24 unpacks the world's most important and least understood industry, international shipping. It provides your shoes and phones, sunglasses and cars. But what happens between the factory floor and your front door? Tune in for gun-toting pirates and widening canals, modern clippers and eco-friendly designs. We'll also tour the biggest ship ever built. That's all this week on The Globalist at 6 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London. Last Friday, Brazilian film enthusiasts gathered in London for the beginning of the 5th annual Brazilian Film Festival. The annual spectacle will play host to 13 feature films and 12 shorts.
Among these is Django Report, directed by Paulo Henrique Fontanelli. The documentary takes a look back at the final years of the former president João Goulart, who lived in exile before his mysterious death. He is the Django of the title, and we're joined by the director, Paulo Henrique Fontanelli. He's in the studio with us now. Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to have you here, Paulo. Explain to us the background of Django Report.
This is an investigation above the Django's death, that is very mysterious. The official story that he was death by heart attack, but we collected proofs that can be possible that he was murdered
and obviously,
with a poison.
And this has gone to the heart of the matter because the National Truth Commission has now announced, they announced in March this year, that they will investigate his death. How far do you think your film is responsible for that decision?
Yeah, it's a very, very beautiful notice because the family, Django family, is trying to do this investigation for 10 years. And the Brazilian government never pay attention to them. After the film came on the cinemas, the government decided to investigate this with serious.
And do you come up with an answer at the end of the film? Do you say who murdered him or why, and if indeed he was murdered?
We give the proofs, the documents, and you can take your own conclusions. We don't say who or why, but there are a lot of documents that proves that he was investigated. He was they are threatening him, and it's very, for me, it's more how can I say?
It's a very contentious issue,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Now, I'm wondering, because he, of course, was the last left-wing leader before Lula, could this film have been made before Lula came to power?
I think not. I think that it was just in democracy we can do a kind of film like this. In my opinion, that Django is just one of a lot of cases in military regimes of a person who was disappeared and murdered.
What was it that prompted you to make this film? Because, as you say, it's a very brave and courageous decision to take on a subject which even the government doesn't want to address.
I'm sorry?
Why did you want to make this film? What was it that made you decide that this film needed to be made?
It was we began to this work 4 years ago. It was, in the beginning, it was a project of Roberto Farias and Paulo Mendonça, two other filmmakers from Brazil, that they decided to do a fiction film about Django in the exile. So he asked me to do a research for them. And then in this research, I knew a guy who was in prison in south of Brazil, that he said he was a former agent, secret agent from Uruguay, and he was part of the conspiracy that killed Django. So we interviewed this guy, 8 hours interview, and he tells a lot of details how they produced the death of our presidents. So we began to investigate this event. We take a lot of documents with the secret police in Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil. Some documents in CIA that proves that he was
poisoned. How easy was it to get hold of these documents?
We have a lot of help with human rights movements in Brazil, in Argentina, who give us the documents, and the family Goulart families is also investigated this case for more than 10 years, so they help us a lot.
You make a lot of use in the film of real documentary footage, of archive footage.
Yes, we take a lot of never seen images of the military regimes.
And you've got Django himself making speeches.
Yes, there are a lot of speeches of Django, images of him in exile, and records of John Kennedy saying that the Americans should invade Brazil to take his power.
Paulo Henrique Fontanelli, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24.
So today at 6 p.m., Django reports.
In London.
Oh.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
In just a few moments' time on Midori House, we'll leaf through the Turkish newspapers with our very own Alexandra de Kramer. To prepare us for that and to prepare Alexandra, we've had big smiles from the control room when I told her that we're playing this, her favourite song, it appears ever. This is Kiss Kiss by Tarkan. That was Kiss Kiss.
That wouldn't stop.
It was fantastic. I can completely see why it's your favourite song, Alex. I'm going to be... Move. Absolutely, I'm going to be...
Alexandra de Kramer, you were singing
up
along to that. I suspect it was despite yourself. What exactly is he singing?
He's talking about how to get a girl and how to lure her in, basically.
And
then he wants to grab her and kiss her.
And if he tried that approach with you, would he be in with a chance?
I don't know. He's pretty handsome. I don't know if you've seen him recently.
Well, Alex, sadly, it's almost time to kiss you goodbye because this is the last newspaper you're going to be doing for us. You're moving on to expand your Turkish horizons. But what do you have for us today?
So today... All newspaper headlines are obviously about the democracy package that's going to be introduced in less than an hour by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, our prime minister. I think it's interesting that it's a democracy package and he did not invite to the press conference, the opposition press. So people that have been writing against him were not invited.
He doesn't seem to have asked anybody else about it.
No, no, he just gave the decision. Yesterday, I think an interesting headline from Hurriyet newspaper was the opposition party, MHP, it's a nationalist movement party, denounced the democracy package, which was obviously expected. But I think it's interesting to know some points that are going to... that makes this democracy package so interesting, because it's a deal breaker for AKP in the light of the March elections. If they kind of get the Kurdish party, that representative in the parliament at the moment, to their side, they will probably get 50% of the votes in March. And it's the first time ever, I think, that it's going to be included in the package, that they will allow you can campaign during the elections in a different language. So it's going to be probably the first time in Turkish history that people will be campaigning in Kurdish.
This will open it up to everybody. Kurds, Roma, non-Muslim minorities. This could fundamentally change the way that Turkey is driven politically, couldn't it?
Yeah, I agree with you, definitely. Because to some extent, language has a huge role in terms of unifying everyone. And two points that are in this package is that some Kurdish letters that were banned in 1928, when the Republic was born, are reintroduced to the alphabet, which means that also Kurdish will be taught in schools. So it's all this kind of reaction. So basically the kids that start school age of 7, it's going to be a norm for that for them to have Kurdish letters, to have Kurdish as an elective language, to hear Kurdish in campaign elections, which will create a totally different society from what I grew up in, because that was totally unacceptable.
What are the Turkish papers saying? I mean, what's their take on it?
To tell the truth, since Gezi Park, it's been so polarized, I feel like people are not really debating what should be debated, whether it's good for the future. They're not thinking ahead, like in 10 years, how this will change the entire social economical structure of Turkey. The paper, as everyone's talk, is scared because Abdullah Öcalan, who's the leader of PKK, he's held in İmralı at the moment. And everyone's talking about how the government is still dealing with him. He shouldn't. He's considered a terrorist. He's an icon for all these young Turkish men who've been killed throughout the 30-year battle between the PKK and basically the BDP, which is the Kurdish party represented in the parliament, and the PKK. It's seen as part of PKK to some extent. And it's always this thin line between how do you deal with terrorists, or it's considered in Turkey a terrorist group.
Because they think he's calling the shots, don't
they? Yeah, and he is. Like, when he first got in jail in 1999, in the first 4 years, he asked to sit down with the government and said, I'll negotiate anything. Now, the government has approached him and he's actually calling the shots. We had the chance. Why now? Are we in the? We should be in the leading position, and we're not, in a way.
Now, there's some worrying news about Al Qaeda.
Yeah. So this was a report published this weekend by Radikal newspaper about, first of all, that they have pictured the black Sharia flag on the Syrian Turkish border, which we had talked about last week, and that it was taken over by Al Qaeda, and I think it's going to be like a training camp. Also, a worrying thing is that they made a research and they're saying that a lot of Turkish youth on the east coast, the east side of Turkey, are joining the Syrian civil war because of money, or they've been brainwashed because we have so much Syrian influx.
What is it that's actually bringing them? You say it's money, but what is it? Is there a lack of opportunity in Turkey which is making them look elsewhere?
To some extent, I guess there is a lack of opportunity in the east part of Turkey. Hence, there's been lots of development in the past 10 years. But I guess it's still not enough. And at the end of the day, there's also the PKK that's a really prominent group there that recruits young people. So I feel like it's an opportunity for the Syrians as well to bring more people to their cause. Like the report said that the town of Adıyaman, the province of Adıyaman, had more than some 200 young men join in Syria, and they had an interview with the dad that had to go to Aleppo to bring back a 16-year-old son because he was just like, he just, you know, when they say like he just was with the bad crowd and just got carried away.
Caught up. Let's move on to the Prime Minister Erdogan not only unveiling a democracy, but it's also a fertility program that he'd quite like everyone to embark
he
upon.
He loves talking about fertility. And this has been...
Ew.
This has been like a huge debate for like 2 years now. That and this weekend he said everyone should have 3 children. And now this has come up to 4. I think to some extent this has always been misunderstood because everyone thinks it's because he's Islamic and he just wants the Turkish population to grow. But people forget that it's important. Turkey has a really huge young population, and what they're scared is like the growth rate of the young population, the birth rate is dropping. And about like 25 million youth at the moment that's below the age of 25. When they grow up in 20 years, if they don't have 3 or 4 kids, we won't have a pension plan, or our pension plan will not be able to support itself. So that's the main cause of that. And I thought it was interesting.
Very, very briefly, I mean, do people actually agree with the idea of having 4 children?
No, obviously, no. Everyone's against it. But it's like people can't come across like, how can my prime minister tell me how many kids I have? So that's like the biggest argument.
Alex, as we said, this is your last paper review. It's not because you're going off to take up that
or to have 4 children.
To have 4 children. No, you're not going off to breed. Alexander de Krump, thank you so much for being here with us and good luck to you.
Thanks.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusta Pacheca and Harriet Thorpe, and our studio manager, Bill Luthi. Up next is the news and then The Urbanist.
Your host for that, of course, will be Andrew Tuck. Myself and Victoria Graham will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Do join us for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Georgina Godwin.
Goodbye and thank you for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.